Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialists, Julia Hurley. Thank you, Julia. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, today we're just going to look at IMHA and ITP, and we'll start by just having a definition, looking at the causes of the disease, who's more likely to get it, and what the clinical signs are, what the treatments are, and where our role is as nurses. Is that better? Good. Okay, fine. So first of all, a definition. Immune-mediated disorders of all kinds occur when the protective immune response is activated inappropriately, resulting in organ injury. In other words, the immune system of the animal or even ourselves can suddenly just kick into action for no apparent reason, picks on some part of the body and causes organ injury. There are two types of primary of autoimmune disease. You're probably aware of this. There's primary and secondary. In the case of primary autoimmune disease, this is reserved for disorders in which no underlying cause can be identified. So it's therefore believed that the immune system has just an underlying dysfunction or imbalance, which has meant that it's begun to act inappropriately. Secondary immune-mediated disease has many of the same presenting signs, as we'll look at in a moment, but this is an immune-mediated disorder in which an underlying reason for the autoimmune response can be identified. And there are a variety of causes for this. This can include infection, exposure to certain drugs and toxins, some cancers, and it's believe that some vaccine administration can make animals more prone to developing some immune responses. In the case of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, ITP, the immune system specifically forms antibodies mediate accelerated destruction of platelets. So it's the platelets that are being destroyed. And it's diagnosed in about 5% of all thrombocytopenias in dogs. So it's the most sort of common cause of a thrombocytopenia in dogs. It's an immune response. It's the most common cause. It's primary is ITP is the most common in dogs rather than secondary. And in cats, it's actually quite rare. If you see it, it tends to be as a result of a secondary cause. So what are the causes of ITP? They're suspected to be environmental. Nobody quite knows what causes it. Certain kinds of stress, that can be stress from illness or environmental or change. Certainly, changes in environmental temperature have been reported to be the causes of ITP. Hormonal changes, again vaccination, and the stress of surgery can sometimes cause an animal to develop ITP. Secondary causes can include neoplasia, infection, and exposure to drugs, vaccines or toxins. So if it's not a primary cause, then the secondary causes can be those. In the case of immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, this is referred to as a clinical syndrome in which anemia results from the accelerated destruction of red blood cells. It's the most common cause of hemolytic anemia in dogs, but again, it's rare in cats. A primary IMHA, the antibodies are directed against red blood cells. And in some cases, you get ITP as well. So the animal is suffering from destruction of both red blood cells and the platelets as well. So this is actually called Evans syndrome, where you get the two together. And this can be seen quite commonly in practice. As far as the red blood cells are concerned, this can actually happen within the vasculature or outside the vasculature. So it's referred to as intravascular or extravascular hemolysis. As far as when it's extravascular, macrophages in the liver or spleen phagocytize and remove antibody-rich blood cells. And in the case of intravascular, red blood cells are removed, actually occurs within the circulation, and this leads to the release of free hemoglobin into the plasma. Extravascular is a lot more common than intravascular. It's a much less acute process, so the animals that present with extravascular hemolysis tend to have less severe clinical signs than the ones that it's a more chronic process. So how do we know whether an IMHA is primary or secondary? So in the case of primary IMHA, it's only really diagnosed by ruling out all other secondary causes. So there's going to be a lot of diagnostic testing, which we'll discuss a little bit later before we come to the conclusion that that is a primary or idiopathic IMHA that the animal is suffering from. Dogs, as I've previously said, they mainly suffer from primary or idiopathic. So that is 60-75% of dogs that have IMHA, it's from a primary cause. In the case of cats, it's actually very rare to see a cat with primary IMHA. They normally have a secondary IMHA. In other words, there's something else going on that we need to find out and investigate before we can start treatment with them. So are there any particular features that make certain animals more prone to developing ITP or IMHA than others? Well, yes, they just seem to be. There's no absolute proof, but there does seem to be some sort of correlation between certain things and animals developing IMHA. Certainly when it comes to dogs, it tends to be young to middle-aged dogs that develop it. The average age is 6. And with cats, the average age is 3 years. So you don't tend to see it in older animals. It seems to be fairly young animals, which I think from owner's point of view can actually be more distressing, particularly with the primary IMHAs, which you've got a Springer Spaniel running around the fields one day and 2 days later it's in hospital and very, very sick. So it can be quite a sort of shocking disease for owners to cope with. Certainly female and neuter dogs seem to be more prevalent in them, more predisposed compared to entire males. Nobody quite knows why that's the case. It could have a hormonal element, but they seem to be overrepresented as opposed to entire males. There does seem to be certain breeds that are more likely, and we'll have a look at that in a moment. This is the breeds that you find are more likely to get it. And there has been a possible seasonal link to warmer months of the year. Again, this isn't proven, but it does seem to happen more during the warmer summer months of the year. And it's a good excuse to put a nice picture there of a river. Okay, so let's have a look. We've discussed sort of briefly primary IMHA, and let's have a look at the causes that can cause a secondary IMHA. As we said earlier, a neoplastic disease can be an underlying cause. So we see quite a lot of cases in the practice I work of lymphoma, who present as cases of IMHA, hemangiosarcomas, leukemias, and malignant histiocytosis. Obviously, with these dogs, treatment is going to be more complicated because their prognosis may be poor. It's not going to be straightforward, and it may be that we're having to give treatment for the neoplastic disease alongside the IMHAs. So those are things that have to be considered and talked over with the owners when the diagnoses are made. Similarly, chronic inflammation, colitis, discus spondylitis, and polyarthritis, again, they can be underlying causes for the development of ITP and IMHA in dogs. And again, they have to have specific treatment alongside the treatment for the actual disease. You mentioned a little bit earlier about vaccination. There does seem to be a correlation between animals, particularly dogs who've been vaccinated, developing these sort of spontaneous diseases within 2 to 4 weeks. There was a study by Duval in 1996, which in which 58 dogs, 26%, had been vaccinated within the previous 4 weeks. I think there have been subsequent studies that I've perhaps said that that's not necessarily a proven fact, but there does seem to be some sort of correlation, whether the immune system is sort of considering vaccination as a foreign body and jumping into action. I don't know, but there does seem to be a certain correlation. And again, you probably are familiar with this, but there does seem to be a genetic predisposition towards developing the disease. Some dogs particularly seem to be more likely to develop IMHA. Cocker spaniels, they are the ones that I think they make up about a third of the cases seen. We see a lot of Bichon Frise. Springer spaniels spring to mind. We seem to see the majority of the cases I see in the practice I am in Hampshire seem to be Springers, although I think a lot of people own Springers. It's quite a sort of country type of area. So, yeah, I think we'd see a lot of Springer Spaniels. Vintage Schnauzers, again, they seem to be, it seems to be quite common to see them, and Rough Collies, and another couple there as well. Again, infectious diseases are implicated in causing IMHA as in both dogs and cats. Some of these I can't even say, so I'll get you to read them for yourselves. But leishmaniasis, babesiosis, chronic bacterial infections, a lot of them are travel-borne, sort of tick-borne infections. So it's very important when we're taking history of dogs, when they come to us, that you get a travel history. We will be discussing this a little bit more in more detail a little bit later on in the talk, but those sort of tick-borne diseases and other diseases are seem to be making dogs more vulnerable to developing IMHA. Similarly, in cats, there are infectious diseases that seem to sort of be secondary causes to IMHA. For example, FIP, feline infectious peritonitis, in your pure breed cats. The feline leukemia virus and some chronic bacterial infections all seem to be quite prevalent secondary causes for IMHA in cats. So what are we going to find when these animals are presenting to us? The practice I work, we tend to see most of our IMHA patients come in as emergencies rather than sort of routine patients. I work in a referral centre, so the ones that we see, I guess, tend to be the sicker ones. Quite often, I mean, the general thing with a routine sort of emergency is that we as nurses do get very involved. It may be that the clinician's busy when the patients arrive, and I'm sure that's the same in your practice, and you're actually asked to go out and triage those patients straight away. So we'll go out and we'll have a sort of brief discussion with the owners, and if the patient is looking very severely collapsed, we will suggest to them that it's probably better if we take them straight through to the hospital so we can start working on them as quickly as possible. Generally, that gives the clinicians a chance to sort of pop over and have a look at them briefly and give us some instructions so we can start working as soon as possible on them. And it gives them an idea when they're speaking to the owners of what we're actually dealing with. So generally, animals with IMHA, particularly the ones with an acute primary one, they will present as lethargic and anorexic. Those with a more chronic history, the owners may say that they've been under the weather for a few weeks. They've been inappetent, which may have developed to anorexia. They certainly have pallor, their pale mucous membranes. They may be ecteric, there may be a hepatic disease developing as well, so they'll be jaundiced. They may be vomiting, and the extreme ones, as in the case of this little dog that came in to see us, was at the state of collapse and weakness. And from a nursing perspective, the first thing we would do with a patient that arrived in this condition would be to give it some oxygen therapy. It may be of a limited value if it's really anemic, but certainly tissue hypoxia is on the top of the list of the damaging effects of this disease. We would check the IV straight away. I mean, with a sick animal, you need to get IV access as quickly as possible. So we would be checking any IVs that have been placed by referring vets, and if they're patent, obviously leaving them, but if they're not, then we would be replacing them. The way we handle these patients is very important. We'll be discussing this a little bit later on. They are very prone to infection, and some of the treatments we're going to give them, if appropriate, will make them even more prone to infection. So we need to sort of be very aware that they are very, very vulnerable at this stage. Physical examination, we'll find additional findings in dogs. Many of our patients, due to the effects of the anemia, will have systolic heart murmur. They may very well be pyrexic. They certainly will have some form of tachycardia, tachypnea, again, pallor, icterus, splenomegaly, hepatomegaly, and quite often they'll have quite severe abdominal pain. Similarly, in cats, when you speak to the owners, as they are, it's more prevalent for them to have a secondary IMHA and ITP. It might have been a disease that's been going on for a little bit longer, so they're not necessarily quite so sick, but that's not necessarily the case. But the owners will say that they've been lethargic, they've been going off their food for a while, they may have been anorexic for the last couple of days, prior to the visit to the vets. They will be pale. Their mucous membranes may be jaundiced, they might have been vomiting, and they may have developed pica, so they're eating weird things that they wouldn't necessarily be eating when they're fit and healthy animals. And again, similarly with cats, they may very well have developed some sort of systolic heart murmur. They certainly, on occasions, will be pyrexic. They may be suffering from hypothermia. They may have a lymphadenomegaly, and they will be pale, and they may very well show signs of jaundice, as the cat does in this picture here. So, as I said before, it's very important, if we're going to get an effective diagnosis, we need to have a full history of these animals. So it needs to include any environmental factors, any toxins that they might have been exposed to recently, any inappropriate drug exposures they might have eaten. They may have any travel history, as we said before. Some of the diseases that can lead to ITP, IMHA, are travel-borne sort of diseases. So we need to know whether they've been abroad recently, what their full vaccination history is. Again, we need to know what their full medical history is, whether this is a recurrence of a previous bout of IMHA or ITP. Whether they're epileptic, because certainly fenobarbital and some drugs like that can lead to this kind of illness, and exposure to infectious agents. So a thorough physical examination is required when they come in. On top of that, it's very, very important when you have a sick animal that you get a good baseline of what's going on. So you need to know what the temperature of the animal is. You need to know what the heart rate is and the respiration rate is and the blood pressure, all those things, and they need to be recorded. You need to get a weight of the animal when it first arrives as well. Obviously, because we're going to be treating those animals with medication, we need to know weights and things, but we need to be getting a baseline so that we can pick up on whether the animal is improving or deteriorating during its hospital stay. So although it seems to be very basic stuff, all these things are actually really, really important that we take note of them and sort of don't leave them to chance. So generally, when we get a patient in, we will get a list of instructions from our clinicians. They'll come rushing over, they'll do a quick examination, and they'll probably go back and speak to the clients, and at that point they'll say, right, this is what I need to do. So it's down to us. So generally they'll want a complete gut blood count and just to see what the I'll do a PCV, total solids, platelet count, just to see what's actually going on in the blood, what we can find. They'll run a serum biochemical profile. We need to know what's happening with the liver and the kidney, whether there's any concurrent disease going on, and whether what's happening with the electrolytes as well, whether the animal's going to need fluid therapy or not. Similarly, urine analysis. This may be something that is if the animal is recumbent, then possibly not something we can do. But if we're placing urinary catheters at that point, we can take a sample. It may be something that we leave till the animal has been sedated, possibly for ultrasonography, to take a cysto. But if it's able to walk out, then we may be doing a free catch sample as well, because we need to be checking for any blood that's in the urine, just to make sure that this animal isn't bleeding out. If it's thrombocytopenic, whether it's bleeding into its bladder, and other signs as well. And again, we may be asked to do thoracic our abdominal imaging. In the case of some neoplasias, we need to be looking to see what's happening in the lungs and in the abdomen as well. So we're pretty busy bees once these animals arrive. We also will be placing catheters and IVs, and we'll be talking about placement of those in a little bit, in a while. So maybe you're asking, I don't know, are there any specific diagnostic tests that we're going to be doing at this point that we can help us to sort of reach a diagnosis, or that specifically say, yes, this is IMHA. Well, one of those tests is the slide agglutination test. It may be something you're all very familiar with. I've just written a little bit instruction sort of thing I found here. So basically, you'd be putting one drop of saline to 5-10 drops of blood of the patient and mixing it on the slide and sort of swirling it around. And if the red blood cells begin to clump together, spontaneous agglutination, that is considered a diagnostic for immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. So that might be something that you're asked to do as the animal arrives, one of the sort of quick tests. Other tests that, again, you might be asked to do are the Coombs test. A Coombs test is performed, is to detect the presence of antibodies against red blood cells, and it's used to support a diagnosis of IMHA. And up to 66 to 75% of dogs who report a positive Coombs test do actually have IMHA. So it's not a conclusive result, but it's pointing us in the right direction that this is what we're dealing with. And the other test that we may be asked to do, possibly not at that point in time, but if appropriate and if the animal is able to have some sort of GA, will be a bone marrow aspirates and core. There's a couple of slides here just to show you the equipment that you will be needed for doing a bone marrow aspirates. I did find a very good link on how to do bone marrow aspirates with IDEX. So if any of you wanted to get hold of that, I can email that to you later. There's the slides that you put the aspirates on. And here's one of our clinicians, our resident, showing off how well he can do a blood smear. In the case of thrombocytopenia, obviously a platelet count is going to be one of the important things that we're asked to do. So we'll get used to doing blood smears. He was very proud of himself for doing that. He actually wasn't very good, but never mind. Okay, so considerations for treatment. As you probably are all aware, IMHA, ITP, often the disease often has a poor prognosis, basically because of some of the conditions that sort of can come of it. But and the treatment options can be very expensive, as we've seen, certainly in the practice I'm in. You know, we'll be looking at doing ultrasound and x-rays, a lot of blood tests, and the patients probably will be in hospital for quite a long time. So it's important to communicate with the owners and make sure that they're on board with the fact that the prognosis isn't necessarily guaranteed, that they're going to get their pet back. It may be that they physically can't afford to treat. So again, that's quite an acceptable answer. And it's going to involve a high level of supportive care. And certainly if we find that the animal has got underlying disease, some neoplasias and things, it might not be appropriate to treat that animal. You may find that actually it's actually too sick and that euthanasia is probably a better option. But here we've got a picture of a little dog called Nelly. She came in to see us last year. She was only 3-year-old little Pasteur cross. And she was a very sick girl. She had a lot of blood transfusions and plasma transfusions. And in fact, her owner ran out of money. And we, in the end, I think my boss decided that we'd give her another try. And she had an extra transfusion. And that was the point at which the tables were turned for her. And unfortunately, the lady couldn't have her back for various reasons, so she came to live with my brother, and she's now living a very happy, healthy life with him and has been a great, great companion to him. So yeah, there are very good outcomes. But dear old Nelly, she had quite a rough ride, but looking at her now, you wouldn't believe that she was ever sick at all. So the potential complications of this disease: pulmonary thromboembolism, very nasty, disseminated intravascular coagulation, DIC, again, very life-threatening, the pair of those. So, and they are relatively common. So they are, it isn't an easy thing to treat, and the results aren't guaranteed to be successful. But if we do decide to treat, we need to look at what the goals of treatment are and where our role as nurses comes into that. So the first one is prevention of red blood cell hemolysis. We've got to stop those red blood cells being destroyed, because until we do that, the animals really can't begin to recover. The fact that there's no red blood cells running around the system of these patients means that there's going to be a degree of tissue hypoxia, and that obviously is going to be very detrimental to the organs of the body, will make the prognosis for this patient even less. So alleviation of tissue hypoxia by blood transfusion is the next line of defense. These patients are very prone to develop thromboembolism. So again, we want to look at treatment to stop that happening. And we've got to look at provision of supportive care. These animals are very sick, so we need to look at how we're going to look after them while all these other treatments are beginning to take effect. And that is, as nurses, that's where we really, we come into our own. As it says here, aggressive supportive care is critical to the outcome of patients with RMHA. So this may include fluid therapy. For patients where there's evidence of dehydration, this will enhance tissue perfusion. It may seem sort of contraindicated to infuse patients which are very anemic, because it's actually going to push the PCV down lower, which is quite scary, but actually it gives you a more accurate view, and you can actually see what the true anemia is for that patient. So the increased tissue perfusion and the increase, we then can sort of start to treat them, is better for them. We also need to think about treating the underlying disease. We won't be sort of necessarily going into that so much during this talk, but that's always going on in the background. So if you've got a neoplasia, if you've got an infectious disease, we maybe need to be adding antibiotics for infectious diseases. For neoplasia, these animals may eventually need surgery. They certainly will need to start chemotherapy as well. So these treatments will be running alongside any treatment that we're actually giving for the immediate disease that we're talking about today. So immunosuppression, this is the prevention of red blood cell hemolysis, and this is how this is going to start. So glucocorticoid therapy in the form of prednisolone is the sort of first basis of treatment. And this can last 4 to 6 months in before the animals are actually weaned off of the preds. I mean, if this is a successful treatment, it is actually a relatively cheap one. And for some dogs, they do very well on that, and that's all that is required. So you'd be looking at 2 mg/kg per os once a day, or if you're going to give it IV, dexamethasone 0.2 to 0.3 mg/kg IV. Every 24 to 48 hours. This would gradually be reduced by 25% within 2 to 4 weeks, and that's dependent on how well the red blood cell count is in, the platelet count is doing. So obviously this needs to be checked and verified before we start to reduce any of the medication. Generally, most dogs respond, show some sign of response within 7 days of treatment, but it could take up to 2 to 4 weeks before you get a full therapeutic effect of this first line of treatment. As we all know, steroid therapy comes with side effects, and these are things that we as nurses need to be aware of. The animals quite often become polydipsic and polyuric. So if they are hospitalised, we may need to be thinking about taking them out for walks more frequently to prevent them from soiling their bedding and getting urine schooled. It may be more appropriate if they're very sick and recumbent that we think about placing urinary catheters and maintaining those catheters for them. And there's quite an argument for that, which again we'll look into in a little bit later in the talk. Similarly, the owners need to be aware that long-term steroid treatment will have these side effects. Animals may be polyphagic, so they may become scavengers when they've previously been quite well behaved in that way. So then again, they're going to be in danger of sort of eating all sorts of foreign bodies and goodness knows what else. Muscle wastage is another sign, and again, poor wound healing and increased susceptibility to infection are side effects. So these animals need to be kept away from other animals that may have infectious diseases, and certainly within the hospital we need to be separating them from other patients because they are so immune suppressed. So I would say they need to be protected from infection. Just going to have a quick sort of a word here. Ensure gold standard hygiene protocol. Just a little bit word about sort of how we get that gold standard. And some of it's very, very basic. It's looking at our hand hygiene protocols. I know that it's very easy to get lazy and sort of not be washing your hands properly. And I find in practice it's quite useful. We quite often just rerun through how everybody is washing their hands, that they're doing it in the proper method, that we're all using the sterilium before we touch patients, particularly as you're going from one patient to the other, and you're also using it in the proper manner as well, and giving enough contact time for it to really take full effect. And certainly with these patients, it's appropriate if you're handling catheters and particularly urinary catheters to be wearing gloves. It's important that they avoid contact with other inpatients, and if they are really vulnerable, then they need to be walked in different areas as well. And again, handle with care if they are thrombocytopenic. These animals are very vulnerable to bleeding, so we need to be careful when we handle them and when we take them out. Perhaps put them on harnesses rather than lead walk them. And there's just a little sign. We use sterilium in practice. I think it's more common now. Another important fact, I think, is to try and increase the number of points where sterilium is around the hospital, because I think people tend to use it more frequently if it's more. It's a bit like in hospitals when you go in, they put it outside every ward, and you sort of feel guilty if you walk past it. I think the more little stations you have around the building, the more compliance you'll get among staff to actually using those sort of products. Certainly we've ordered quite a few more, so that we can't really sort of go anywhere without walking past them. And we actually have one from when we walk from the sort of admin part of the building, you know, after lunch. It's just on the wall there, and most people as they pass will sort of put some in their hands and clean them as they're walking back into the hospital. So all these things are very important to bear in mind. And I think there's scientific evidence to say that you can reduce infection in hospitals by as much as sort of 70% purely by good hand hygiene. And again, kettles and things need to be kept clean. They need to be cleaned out and thoroughly disinfected once a day. And bedding needs to be kept clean as well to ensure patients are keeping as free as infection as possible. So let's move on quickly. So the second line of treatment, unfortunately, first line steroids don't always work, so sometimes they require a second line of immunosuppressive drugs. And the choice of drugs for dogs would be azathioprine, it may be cyclosporine, mycophenolate, clorambucil. And these drugs are all cytotoxic, so they do require barrier nursing. And the side effect of those also, they include pancreatitis and gastrointestinal signs, and again, an increased risk of infection. Nursing implications for this are that all our staff need to be fully trained in how to handle both patients and that have had cytotoxic treatment and in handling cytotoxic drugs. So it's very important that all people are used to wearing gowns and sort of thick purple gloves if they're going to handle the patients. And certainly if they're giving the drugs, we have our own designated room, but the people should be wearing masks and goggles, and all drugs and cytotoxic waste needs to be disposed of in the purple bins. And there's a couple of pictures here I've done for you of a patient that's receiving cytotoxic therapy. So we always mark our kennels with the cytotoxic tape, just so that anybody coming into the hospital knows that those animals need to be handled with protective clothing on. We label all our blood samples with cytotoxic stickers so that when the samples are sent off to the lab, everybody's pre-warned that they need to be careful and handle, you know, with care when they're using the samples. We also use yellow bandage for IV lines as well, again as an alert to people that the patients are receiving cytotoxic therapy, and all the waste goes into special cytotoxic bins. And again, there are implications that we need to look out for. These immunosuppressive drugs can cause bone marrow suppression, infection, gastrointestinal ulceration. There can be hemorrhage, so we need to look out when we're taking the animals out to the loo just to make sure for any signs of melena. They can develop Cushing's disease. And thrombocytopenia itself, they're much more likely to develop vasculitis and ischemia and gastrointestinal hemorrhage. Okay, let's move on quickly. So we've discussed the first two lines of events. The next one will be blood transfusion. We need to stop the tissue hypoxia, and the best way of doing that is blood transfusion. And in the case of the ITPs, we do use fresh frozen plasma. It's need dependent on the individual patient. Some patients who've had a chronic anemia may be coping very well, but if an animal is presented in its tachycardic, tachypneic, it's been anorexic, it's lethargic, and it's weak at rest, and certainly if it's got a hematocrit of less than 15%, it's going to have a degree of tissue hypoxia, and it's going to benefit from a blood transfusion. Tissue hypoxia itself is what causes an awful lot of the problems with our IMH patients. It can cause hepatic necrosis and DIC and thromboembolism. So it's the actual hypoxia itself that is doing the damage. So the sort of mainstay of treatment for these patients is blood transfusion. We always have packed red blood cells in stock, and we've recently started importing packed red blood cells for cats from Portugal, which is quite exciting, and it just makes it an easier and a quicker to treat those patients as quickly as possible. Certainly, I think with most IMHAs, where you haven't got a sort of volume, a loss of blood in quite the same way as other things, packed red blood cells are quite appropriate rather than whole blood. I suppose in Evans syndrome, there would be an argument for giving whole blood because you're going to get the plasma element as well. But generally, with an IMHA, we'll just be using packed red blood cells, which we get from the PET blood bank. So the nursing implications, we've been asked by our vets to get that transfusion going as quickly as possible. So what do we need? So we basically need a basic PCV total solids baseline. We need a baseline TPR, so we need to triage these patients. We need to get the temperature, the pulse rate and the respiration rate. And we then need to find out the blood type of that patient. Again, we need to get the history of the patient, what sort of whether it's had a blood transfusion before, because if it has, then we're going to need to cross-match any blood that we're going to try and give it to make sure that those two are compatible. And when that's all done, we will start to transfuse the animals. I won't go into a huge amount of detail of transfusion today because that's obviously a whole new different topic, but you know, it's important that the nursing staff are all fully trained to be able to give blood transfusions. In our practice, we start with a sample of 0.5 mils per kilo per hour. And we'll do that for the first half hour, and we'll probably take obs every quarter of an hour. And we dedicate a nurse to that transfusion. And during that time, we'll be again looking at the heart rate, temperature, and resp rate. And we're looking for signs of transfusion reaction. And those signs can include sort of panting, if there's a raise in heart rate, a raise in temperature. We're also looking for signs of restlessness and swelling, possibly of the face around the muzzle, but also of the limbs as well. Generally now, we don't tend to give chlorpheniramine unless there are signs of transfusion reaction. I think that's probably clinician-based. In the past, we've always got in chlorpheniramine before a transfusion, but at present, that doesn't seem to be the trend. But we transfusions, I think it's very important that we as nurses are confident to know what a transfusion reaction looks like. And as soon as we do see something, if we're worried about anything, it's very important that we tell the clinicians as soon as possible so that they can make the decision as to whether we carry on or whether we stop. If after the initial half hour we're happy that everything is going according to plan, then we'll increase that rate to sort of 5 mils per kilo per hour, and hopefully that will... and the aim is to get the transfusion in within sort of the next 4 hours. And quite often animals will need repeat transfusions during their stay with us, and we'll be repeating PCVs, total solids, possibly daily, just to see how they're doing. Okay, moving quickly on. The prevention of thromboembolism. TEs occur in sort of 29 to 80% of dogs with IMHA. It is a big risk, and the increased risk is in cause by the following things: IV catheter placement, leukocytosis, hypoalbuminemia. The actual cause of why thrombolism occurred is not known. So how do we prevent this from happening? So we would be giving anticoagulants, heparin, aspirin, or a combination of both to stop those clots forming. We'll be monitoring. That's another thing that we may be asked to do when the animals first are presented, is to get coagulation times of those animals, so the APPT time. And if that's very short with these patients, then we're aiming to prolong that by 25 to 50% from the time of admit, to cut down the risk of thromboembolism. So apart from the sort of three lines of defence, we also need to think about other things. I think that the main three things that we need to think about while those patients are with us are analgesia, medication and nutrition. So we'll have a quick look at those now. Pain. I think any thrombolysm is a very, very painful thing. These animals are prone to DIC, they're prone to developing pancreatitis. There is going to be, they may have hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, there is going to be a degree of pain involved in what they're going through. So it's very important as nurses that we are able to assess that pain. And pain scoring, I think, is a very important part of our job, and something that we should be doing on a regular basis with our patients, because we all know that if animals are in pain, it does delay healing. So I think it's quite useful. There's a couple of charts there which are readily available and online, and they're quite sort of simple to work from. They're not too technical, but they are a good way of starting to assess whether our patients are in pain or not. Generally in practice, we're quite lucky. We do have resident anaesthetists, and they're great for helping us with sort of multimodal pain relief. So a lot of our animals will be basically on something like methadone, but if they really are very, very painful, we may be putting them on ketamine CRIs and introducing sort of paracetamol and other lidocaine and other things to help them with that pain relief. Gastroprotectants, they form quite an important part of looking after these patients. As we mentioned earlier, a lot of them can develop gastric ulceration and those kind of things. So metprazole, ranitidine, they may be all on the list medication that these animals need to receive. A lot of patients have been vomiting, so it may be that we'll be giving them antiemetics, such as sirenia, again, intravenous fluids, which we mentioned earlier, for those animals that are not normal or volemic. Again, nutrition is something important to think about. These animals need to be fed a low-fat diet due to the increased risk of pancreatitis. We tend to feed them GI low-fat. I guess if you're trying to attempt to get an animal that's been an appetite to eat, then chicken or fish might be an appropriate place to start as well. I think often anorexic patients, when they're sick, it takes a lot more than that to actually get them eating. We do use a drug called mirtazapine sometimes as an appetite stimulant, but I think anorexic patients generally require feeding tubes to get them going. And again, it's down to costs. Some owners may not be able to afford, or some owners don't want to give their animals feeding tubes. So a nasoesophageal tube may be a more appropriate choice, or esophageal feeding tubes. We place them quite regularly with animals who have got are going to be staying with us for a while. Again, you've got to be a little bit careful, because that's a GA and these animals are quite compromised. So that is a choice that a decision that has to be made by the clinicians and the owners as to whether they think that's appropriate. As nurses, our job is obviously to help with placement of these tubes, but also to work out the feeding regime for these animals. So we should be working out what their calorific requirement should be, and we should be feeding to what their normal weight should be. They may be animals that have lost a lot of weight quite acutely, so we should be working it out. And we in practice, we tend to feed, if they haven't eaten for a while, we'll feed 33% down the tube the first day, and then gradually take that up to 66% and up to 100% within 48 hours if the animal is tolerating it well. That's, and we tend to find actually with a lot of them, if everything else is going well, the introduction of feeding tube within 24 hours, we can begin to sort of offer them food by mouth, and quite often they will begin to eat. It's a bit of a joke, really, in practice. You put a feeding tube in and suddenly they say, oh, I don't need that. What did you do that to me for? But they're useful, the O-tubes, because owners can take the animals home with them and be trained to use them themselves. I think we've mentioned before that we will be monitoring PCV closely, probably once a day, twice a day, depending on the how sick the animal is. But we also need to be aware of, actually, by taking blood, these are animals that are anemic, so we must be as careful as we can just to take the right amount of blood, because actually taking blood samples can cause anemia itself. So we need to bear that in mind. And again, with the thrombocytopenic patients, we've got to be very careful if we are taking jugular samples that we take them and apply a lot of pressure afterwards to make sure that there's no bruising. And I would say with a lot of the sick patients, there's no shame in asking perhaps the nurse who's best at placing IVs and taking blood samples. And perhaps for the people who are less experienced, practice on something that is a bit more bouncy and healthy with better veins. Just a quick sort of word about generally placing catheters. And again, all these animals are very prone to infection. So it's really important that we clip nice big patches, that we're preparing the sites for blood sampling and for IV catheter placement well. You're using your chlorhexidine, sort of 50-50 dilution. You're making sure that you've got a nice big area clipped. You're doing, if possible, clean stick samples. And those IV catheters are being checked at least twice a day. And you're using sterets if you're introducing medication into the IVs. And again, making sure that our hands are being thoroughly cleaned and washed every time you're touching those sites. As I say, the catheter site should be checked at least twice a day for any signs of infection. And again, when you're taking temperatures, think about how long those IVs have been in. Do they need to be changed? And are they the thing that's causing an increase in temperature if that's occurred? Quickly, urinary catheter placement. Again, reason for placement. You may have a recumbent placement, so it's going to be much easier. But we need to monitor the urine output for the quantity, specific gravity, hemoglobinuria, in order to detect renal failure in these animals, and intravascular hemolysis. And they're also useful to adjust for fluid therapy. So there is quite a good argument for placing urinary catheters in the animals. But again, they can be a source of infection, so it's important that strict aseptic technique is used to place them, and during management they need to be cared for very carefully, using gloves, and be cleaned regularly and checked regularly. So how do we know these animals are deteriorating? It's important that we know signs of deterioration. So change in mentation, tachycardia, tachypnea, decrease in appetite, pale mucous membranes, some abdominal swelling, hypothermia and pyrexia could all be signs that the animals are not doing so well, and these are things that we need to communicate. So I want to just have a quick word at the end. Sorry, I'm running a bit long now. Just the importance of good record keeping when we're dealing with these patients. It's very important that we have good concise notes, that you're recording all the medication you're giving, you're signing it off, you're making sure that your clinicians are signing off the medication in the morning, and checking that the dose rates are fine, and that you're writing down your TPRs. You're weighing the patients daily to make sure there's no sign of weight loss or weight gain that's inappropriate. You're writing down the nutrition that the patients are getting, and again, urine and the type of feces that's being produced, looking for signs of hemorrhage and melena. And keep the notes appropriate and concise, because then we know more easily, we know whether things have actually are changing or not. And similarly in hospital, we do have hospital handover sheets, and I think when you're in a big organization like we are, we have staff changes quite regularly. It's very important that the handovers are comprehensive but concise. So ours take the form of, we have a basic sheet which we have the brief clinical history at the top, but we'll be writing down what's happened during the day, any areas of concern that we've had, any changes, and what the ongoing treatment's going to be for the next shift. And then people can constantly look back, and we can get the care of those animals as consistent and possible, and give them the best hope of making a sort of speedy recovery, and getting them out as quickly as possible. So, just to summarise, IMHA and ITP can be either primary or secondary. A primary IMHA and ITP are generally diagnosed by ruling out secondary causes. The goals of our treatment include prevention of red blood cell hemolysis, alleviation of tissue hypoxia with blood transfusion, and the prevention of thromboembolism and the provision of supportive care. Nursing skills, we need to be good at blood sampling and IV catheter placement. We need to be trained in handling cytotoxic drugs and waste and looking after patients who've had cytotoxic treatment. We need to be up to speed with placement and maintenance of urinary catheters, and we need to know how to give a blood transfusion and monitor it. We need as nurses to recognise signs of deterioration in our patients, and we have to need to have good record keeping and observation skills, and we need to have very good colleague communication and provide good handover sheets and verbal communication with each other. Okay, I think that's it. I don't know if anyone's got any questions. If they haven't now, then if they want to email me, I can provide my email address. That's fine. Okay.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Julia for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.